Hey folks, welcome to episode 284 of the FLW Bass Fishing Podcast in Shaftesbury, Vermont. I am Jody White, joined, as always, from Norwalk, Iowa, by the one and only Kyle Wood.
Yes, sir. We're back together.
Absolutely. It is a pleasure, as always, Kyle. You know, Joe misses you a lot. I typically just call you all the time.
We tend to communicate a little more.
Yeah, but it's good to hear your voice always. And we've had like a busy little stretch of bass fishing to talk about, which is good.
Yeah, we have. And we can very much kind of see the light at the end of the tournament fishing tunnel for 2020. But it's been kind of hot and heavy here late.
Yeah, no doubt. Which is kind of fun. I've kind of enjoyed the fall tournaments. We didn't talk about it in our meeting this morning, and we'll probably talk about it when we get to the actual All-American Sun. But mm-hmm. I thought it was cool. I thought it was good. But anyway, we've got probably a good episode. Right off the bat, we're going to throw you to a Chris Macy interview. Chris obviously won the All-American. It was pretty spectacular. Then Kyle will be back. We'll talk about the All-American, about Table Rock, about Seminole, which those wrap up our Toyota Series regular season competition, which is big news. And then we'll kind of look ahead to a couple other derbies and probably call it a day.
I think that sounds just lovely, and I think it's going to be a blast.
All right. Well, in that case, here is Mr. Macy.
All righty. And now we are joined by Chris Macy, our newest Phoenix Bass Fishing League All-American champion. Chris, congratulations, man. What a win.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. It was pretty unbelievable.
So I want to kind of dive into, like, basically who you are and all that, but I guess, first of all, you really haven't fished that many FLW events. This was your first FLW win, and you kind of came back on the final day. I think you were in fifth going out. Like, it sort of looked like Todd Goat had a pretty good handle on things. What did it feel like to win?
Oh, it's just unbelievable, you know, fishing here in the Ozarks, you know, and having to qualify through the Ozark division, you know, just getting to the All-American is a feat in itself, especially the, you know, the stiff competition that we have around this place. So then to put yourself in contention, you know, to do well, not only do well, but, you know, put yourself in contention to win there in the last day, you know, that's just something else.
No doubt about it. Well, I guess tell me a little bit about yourself. I think you said you were a home builder, if I remember correctly. And,
yeah,
you know, how old are you? How long have you been doing this fishing thing? Like, I know you've fished team events with Jeremy Lawyer, but, I mean, the All-American's a super big deal. I want to know all about you.
Yeah, I'm a contractor home builder here in Southwest Missouri. I've done that since I was going to college, and just kind of decided that's what I wanted to pursue as a career. I've always fished, mostly just regionally. You know, way back in the day, we had Heartland and Central Pro-Am, and a lot of those kind of Pro-Am formats, and I fished those back in the day. I've got a great wife and two kids. I got a girl in college. She goes to Pitt State here in Kansas, and I got a boy that's a junior in high school, so they've always occupied a lot of my time. They were big in sports, and we were always running around playing ball, and I wouldn't say that put fishing on the back burner, but that put fishing definitely on the weekends.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot
and definitely regional.
That's one of those things. That's why the, you know, the BFLs are so great, because you can have a chance to fish for a really high level tournament. You know, you can make the All-American. Some guys make it, you know, five or six times, and there's some pretty good payouts at the regionals too. Like, those are pretty big time events, and you don't have to sacrifice months of your life to do it, you know?
Right. You know, in the competition, like I said, especially here in the Ozarks, all these local tournaments, BFLs for sure included, you know, the competition is as stiff as it is anywhere.
Yeah.
And you know, the size of the field and everything, you know, all the BFLs, you know, in our region, you know, that is a big time tournament. Even though it's just a qualifier, you know, when you're talking 100 to 150 boats of some of the best anglers in the country, you know, even the qualifying event is a big deal. So,
yeah, for sure. Well, so one of the things you dropped when we were when I was doing the interview with you after you won is that your team partner is Jeremy Lawyer. And one, I told you this a second ago, but gosh, you guys sound alike. Like, I am pretty sure that if I ever needed to make, like, a voice key or something to unlock a safe that one of you owns, I could use whichever voice I needed, I think.
Yeah.
It's, you guys are dead on. But
yeah,
like,
we've been told that before, for sure.
How did you meet him? Like, how has he shaped your fishing career at all? Because he's obviously gone from the BFLs to, like, being a superstar, basically.
Right. We just met here locally, you know, kind of through fishing, and we just hit it off. I think our fishing styles are a lot alike, and I think, you know, when we're in the boat together, I think we can really just key off of each other and, you know, bounce ideas off of each other. Maybe we ought to try this, you know, because our fishing styles are the same, we're able to kind of put something together, and even though we're fishing the same style, you know, maybe each one of us do something just a little different or put our own little twist on it just a little. And I think that's what makes us, you know, such good partners and definitely the success that we've had.
Yeah, it seems like that kind of it seems like having a team where it's not two people who want to do totally different things. Like, they've got to be similar, but you each have to bring your own little tweaks. Like, that seems to be pretty key.
You bet. For sure.
Next team derby, are you going to roll up and, like, will you both be carrying the trophies with you at takeoff? Because I feel like that would be pretty baller.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too bad. I don't know if there's another team that say that they could do that. So that would be pretty cool.
If there's any place, it would be in the Ozarks.
Because for sure.
You guys have cranked out the All-American champs.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's awesome, man. I know you said when we talked that you were going to kind of keep it regional. Do you think you're going to try to take any steps up, or do you think that it's still going to be BFLs, team derbies, and that kind of thing for you? Which I don't have anything wrong with that. I want to say that totally fairly. Like, I love that strategy, but
yeah,
you've won now.
Oh, I'm not totally ruining out the idea of, you know, maybe trying to make a stab at it. I mean, this is definitely a life-changing event, and, you know, just to have the opportunity, you know, to fish, I don't know if you want to call it for a living, or just to fish at the top tier, you know, against the best fishermen in the world. I mean, who wouldn't want to give that a try? But, you know, I'm talking with some sponsors, and you know, if I could, you know, get some financial help, I'm not saying that it wouldn't be in the cards, but also, you know, I'm pretty big on family, and I like fishing a lot with my son. I've got a son that's 16 years old, and he's ate up with fishing and hunting, and I do a lot of fishing with him. So, you know, a lot of these regional events and the fishing close to home is with him. So I'm not sure that I'm willing to give up that much time yet, you know. If not next year, maybe down the road somewhere, you know, when I get a little more time, I'd definitely like to give a stab at it one of these days.
All right, that's neat. Yeah, because, like, maybe when he gets into college or something, and then if he's gone, or he's doing his own college fishing thing or something like that, well, then maybe that's a good opportunity for you to fish more too.
You bet.
All right, neat. Well, I guess let's dive into the All-American, because I think definitely there's people who are listening to this who want to know how you caught them. Tell me about practice, because I feel like when you have just that one short practice day before the All-American starts, you have to have a productive pre-practice to do well. Like, you're very rarely going to hit the magic hole in that one practice day. So I guess tell me about it.
Well, definitely, you know, we went out there for pre-practice and fished, you know, for 5 or 6 days right before the cutoff. And you know what makes it tough when you're fishing 13 hours away from home is you don't know how those fish are going to react, and you're trying to guess at what's going to happen 10 days down the road when the tournament was to start. And even you're trying to guess the weather and not knowing how those fish react to different things. You know, in your mind, you're playing on the water dropping 5 degrees, and you're trying to watch the forecast and your plans, but you still don't understand how those fish react because you just don't know much about them. And really, even once the tournament started, you know, we really had a whole lot of clouds, you know, the first 2 days of the event, and those fish out there do not like that, which is just totally opposite of how things are here in the Ozarks. You know, you get a good rainy day, the wind blowing a little bit. I mean, that really turns our fish on here. You know, Table Rock, Grand Lake, those lakes, when you have those days, those are your best fishing days. And come to find out, you know, out there for whatever reason, and I still don't understand it, those fish like sun and and do not like
cloud. Everyone talked about that the whole time. It's like, man, we could really use some sun. We could really use some sun. And all I'm thinking is, like, I mean, I guess I get it. You want sun, but fish like to eat when it's cloudy too.
Yeah, yeah, and you couldn't get any more opposite of what I'm used to here in the Ozarks. So that was definitely a struggle to me, trying to adjust to that kind of thing. And, you know, in pre-practice, I bet I put 35 hours on that Mercury motor. I felt like the offshore deal was definitely going to be a player, whether it was going to be enough to win or what. But it was definitely going to be the way to get a limit and at least make a showing, the All-American. So I idled and idled and idled and found offshore brush piles and cane piles. When I was out there for pre-practice, that was definitely the way to catch them. There was not a lot of fish shallow. But then again, you're planning for something that happens, you know, 10 days down the road or so. So you don't really fully understand what you're trying to find. You're just doing the best you can.
No doubt. So like when the tournament started, had you, like on day one, did you basically end up doing the same thing every day and then, and like not have to make too many adjustments until that final day swim bait adjustment? Or were you, did you kind of put it together as it went on?
Well, another one of the big changes that happened, and I don't understand why it happened. Like I said, it's kind of directly opposite of what I would be used to, but I'd found fish in the ditches headed back into the creeks. And in my mind, I kind of assumed that that bite would get better as the water cooled off 5 or 6 degrees. So I had a couple of creeks that I felt like were just full of fish, and I could go in there. I checked them 2 or 3 different times, and I felt like I'd go in there and I could get a limit, you know, in 15 or 20 minutes. Now, they may not have weighed 7 or 8 pounds, but I felt like that was kind of a given, you know, and that would be a good way, you know, to settle in. And then you could run around and start, you know, culling from there, looking for some better quality fish. But we had some fog the first day on takeoff, and it let up just enough that we could run. And I run down to this creek that had just been full of fish. And when I put my live scope down, there was not a fish in sight anywhere.
Wow.
And I no more than did that, and the fog rolled in, and I couldn't even see my motor. I mean, it was so thick. I was trapped inside of this creek for 2 or 3 hours running around trying to catch one. But it just really put a damper on my plans right out of the gate. I felt like I was in scramble mode, you know, from day one. So once the fog lifted, I kind of got to run around. And both days, one and two both, was just a grind for me. You know, I caught 7 or 8 keepers the first day and just 5 keepers the second day. And every bit it was offshore, throwing that swim bait and a drop shot, you know, on those brush piles.
That's the wild thing is that, like, I'm not in a, if it was a BPT style of, or an MLF style event, right, where you had to rely on numbers to a degree, I mean, you might have done something different, but you would not have won the tournament, right? Because on those first 2 days, like, you were running really thin margins, which is cool. Like, it's like really impressive that you were catching quality. You had the right spots figured out that had quality, but it wasn't a slugfest. But man, that last day, like once you figured it out, you opened it up.
Oh, for sure. You know, I did the same thing all 3 days. I was throwing that swim bait. That was by far my most productive bait. And I felt like it was getting bigger bites than maybe what some of the other guys were doing. They were talking about using a drop shot and a shaky head. And I really didn't catch much on those baits. I think I weighed in 1 key largemouth on a drop shot. But every single fish come on that swim bait. And even though I wasn't getting very many bites, I felt like for whatever reason that swim bait was drawing a reaction bite maybe from some bigger fish. And for sure going into that last day, you know, it was a struggle for me. I think it was 11 o'clock. I actually seen you on the water and about 11. And
I rolled up. You didn't have anything. I was like, oh, man, this is bad. Well, no, I'm like, I'll see if he catches a fish.
Yeah, yeah. I wish you'd showed up about 3 hours earlier because you know more and got there. And I set the hook, and, man, it was a good one. And, you know, it was about a three-pounder. And after I got him in the boat, you know, that's what really kind of got me back in the ball game. I'm not saying I was kicking rocks before then, but I was definitely struggling, you know, and I don't feel like I was really doing anything wrong. All my brush piles had a lot of fish on them, but they just wasn't set up right for the swim bait. And I couldn't get them. I just couldn't get them to react. All of the fish were down in the brush. And I was throwing everything but the kitchen sink at them. But until those fish had really located where I needed them up on top of the brush pile, it was definitely a struggle.
Now, is that the fish where you figured out? Because you told me how you figured out to, like, draw them out, and then you could drop your bait down and get a reaction. Was that when you figured it out, or was it later on? Like, was that sort of your starter fish, and then that sort of indicated their positioning right, and then you, like, really dialed it in?
Well, that triggered something for sure. That was not the fish that just absolutely dialed in to what I need to be doing. But all day long, and a big struggle all week out there, was you would constantly, on your live scope, you'd be able to see fish follow your bait.
Yep.
And if you wasn't careful, if you didn't catch a fish, you would pull the entire school to your boat, and they would just lay underneath your boat. And at that point, you could not drop down and catch one of them. So even if you was fortunate enough to catch a fish off of the brush pile, it was usually a done deal. You caught one fish, the school followed him, and it was over. So when you happened to roll up and I caught that good one, I had just come across the top of the brush pile. He was following it, and I was starting to let it fall to the bottom, and that's when I caught him. And that just kind of triggered a light on that maybe I was on a little something. I fished there just a little bit, and when I ran to my next brush pile, man, I could tell right off the bat that these fish were really positioned where I needed them. And all week long, I was looking for what I would call little wolf packs of fish. Any brush pile that would have six or seven fish, all fairly tight grouped, you know, that was the fish what I thought was catchable. I don't know if it creates competition or what, but when those fish would all kind of gang up together with six or seven fish, it seemed like that's the fish that was going to be for easy picking. When I rolled up on this particular brush pile, I seen six or seven good mark, what I would call big marks, what I thought was going to be better than average fish, laying on top of this brush pile. And I fired the swim bait out there, and I could see my swim bait go down, oh, about 10 foot was where they were laying. And when I brought the swim bait across the top of that brush pile, sure as the world, all six or seven of those fish were falling right behind it. And in my mind, I'm thinking, man, I'm going to pull every one of them to the boat again. And for whatever reason, I just thought, I'm going to drop this thing to the bottom. And when I let that bait, I just killed that bait and let it go straight to the bottom. All six or seven of those fish nose straight down on it.
Wow.
And they were just sitting there looking at it. And when I popped it off the bottom and reeled it two or three times real quick, one of them jumped all over it. And I was fighting him to the boat. And I just happened to reach down and hit spot lock on the Altrek and glanced over at my graph, and those remaining six fish were headed right back to the same brush pile where I just caught them from. And that's when the light had kind of clicked on right there that maybe I'd come across something.
Gosh, that is so cool. That's one of those things that there's a lot of reasons to get live scope or whatever your forward-facing sonar is. But, like, man, the things you can learn about fish behavior that you would... There's no way you would learn what those fish did without either having crystal clear water or being on top of them with regular sonar, right? Like, you just could not learn that. It's so incredible.
Nope.
That's awesome. And, like, that's one of those, figuring out that little adjustment to make, like, you could have so easily gone all day and not thought of that or not made that adjustment or tried 100 other baits and not had the baits work or something. So it's so cool how sometimes fishing can be so easy And like sometimes it can be so hard, I guess, is what it boils down to. That's awesome.
Yeah. And you know, I thought about that all the way home. Had a 13-hour drive to kind of take all this in, and that's one of the things, you know, some of the things I was thinking about. You know, what if I hadn't dropped that bait to the bottom, or what if I hadn't stumbled across this group of fish, you know, that was so cooperative, you know, and kind of triggered me into what it was going to take to catch them. But I guess that's just kind of part of it.
That's the thing. Like, there is no, you know, I think that Jamie Rampe, he may occasionally big eye fish a little bit, but on day one, he said he lost like a 3 and a 4 pounder. On the final day, like, he was up the river fishing for largemouth, doing exactly what Jamie Rampe should do, right? Like, how he's won so many tournaments in Hartwell, and he never got a big bite. Like, you know, Todd Goad on the last day, he didn't have live scope. Maybe if he'd had live scope, he would have figured something out and caught 12 pounds and iced it down, or maybe he never would have, and he would have just caught little ones while you were catching big ones. Like, it's so cool when you get into a close tournament, because all those little decisions matter so much. And it really, like, showed at the final day. I mean, Cole Floyd moved up, like, 5 spots, just like you did, because he caught a big bag on the last day, and it was because he had a bait that he didn't have the first 2 days, because John Garrett gave him one of those Jackal Riser baits. Like, there were so many little variables in that tournament. It was cool.
Yes. Yep.
And
I felt like I was around good fish, you know, especially on day two. It seemed like I was around schooling fish most of the day, and I wasn't able to catch those fish for whatever reason. And how you can get 15 or 20 fish busting around your boat and you not catch one is beyond me. I mean, I threw everything I had at them, from a spoon to a swim bait to everything. And I don't know that I necessarily ever caught a schooling fish all week long. But at least it kind of keyed me in onto the type of fish that was in the area. You know, I would constantly see some of the better spotted fish, you know, that I thought was 2.5 pounds to 3.5 pounds. So at least that kind of gave me the confidence that maybe I was in the right area. I was doing the right thing. If I just put my nose down, I was around the kind of fish that that I could do well with. So,
good deal. Yeah, that is – it was a super cool win. What – I know you said you were catching them on a swim bait, but what were you throwing from, like, a rod reel line? And you were throwing the 2.8 Kytec, right?
Yes. Yep. Throwing a 2.8 Kytec and either a Tennessee shad or sexy shad. When the sun really got to shining, it seems like I caught a couple of key fish on the sexy shad. I've got a favorite spinning rod I've had for several years. It's just a 7'4" G Luma spinning rod. I had a loose reel on it. I think one of the big keys, maybe to the presentation that I had, is the fish were really, really finicky, and they were getting boat shy, and I felt like they was probably getting sonar shy. They've really been pestered, you know, the last month. There's been a lot of tournaments on that lake, and these spots have really been worked over. I was using Sunline SX1 braid, 16-pound, for my main leader, and that's a super castable braid, and I was doing my best to stay 60 to 70 feet off of these brush piles and make an extremely long cast and get the bait down there to them without me, without being known, you know, that I was in the area. And that seemed like a major key. Once, you know, if the wind happened to push me too close or whatever, I could just see I could see how the fish were reacting, and they definitely did not like that. So if you could use a stealthy approach, I mean, that was definitely key, I think, to the bites that I was getting.
Cool. What were your settings on your live scope? This is like, I don't even know, like, gain or everything necessarily, but how far out were you running it? Because I've heard some guys were running out to like 120 feet on spot lakes, which seems like a really long way to me. But what were you doing?
I typically, all the time, and, you know, unless I'm crappie fishing or something like that, I will always try and keep mine on about 100 feet.
Okay. That makes sense.
That seems to be where I get the best reading. And also, if you're changing up a lot, if you're not careful, you just get to understanding how everything looks when it's 100 feet. You know, if you find a setting that you're comfortable with, whatever it might be, you know, some of my friends run it on 80. But I think if you just kind of find a setting that you're comfortable with, you kind of get to recognize and how everything looks at that setting. And you just kind of get used to it, and you're able to, you know, make fine-tune adjustments from there.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like, I think that with all electronics, like, that's important, because there's, unless you hit, like, a certain extremely high level of knowing your electronics, it's hard to, like, you'd want to be making adjustments from a base point. You don't want to just be jumping dramatically from one to another, because stuff does look different when you move it around.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's good knowledge to have, though. Like, you know, Troy Morrow is like a superstar with his electronics, and he's told me he runs like, you know, 80 to 100 feet normally, but like if he was on Hartwell, he would run 120. And I don't know if I would want to run 120 on Hartwell personally, and obviously you ran 100 and it worked great. So that's it's just good data to have.
You know, in the live scope, not only just for fishing, but it is such a search tool, I mean, as well. I did a lot of side imaging and that kind of stuff, you know, when I was searching in practice. But, you know, a lot of times you could it was even faster, you know, just to pull in on these points, drop the live scope down, and you could just kind of zigzag across these points. And, you know, I could set it on 100 to 125, and that seemed to be the most efficient way, you know, to cover a lot of things. And I don't know if the accurate is the word, but they're just so sensitive, and you're able to find the cane piles and stuff that some regular sonar might miss.
Yeah,
It is definitely just a great super search tool.
Let's see. Gosh, I had another. Oh, I know. So on that final day, you mentioned that you went to a little bit heavier jig head. When did you make that adjustment? Was that like midway through, or how did that play into it?
Well, even on day two, you know, it was a grind for me, and I was just struggling to get bites. Fish were constantly following my swim baits. So that's another kind of trick I come up with on day two, is I felt like the fish were getting too good a look at a quarter ounce, you know, jig head. Maybe the bait was moving too slow. So kind of the afternoon on day two, that's really maybe what kind of helped me fill out a limit and kept me in the ball game, is I switched to about a 3/8 ounce swim bait head. And I could count it down, and I could really bring it past those fish at a lot faster pace. And I felt like that got a whole lot more of a reaction out of them. Maybe they didn't get quite as good a look at it. And they either had to eat it on the way by, or they was going to miss out. So that was definitely a key adjustment that I kind of come up with in the afternoon on day two that kept me in the ball game for sure.
That is really cool. Well, I tell you what, Chris, I mean, I feel like I've got the lowdown on how you caught them. I know a little bit more about you. Man, thanks for coming on. Is there anything you want to plug, or do you have any social media you want people to follow, or anything like that?
Well, I'm working all that stuff. Me and my social media is pretty much non-existent, but we're working on it. The last week has been pretty crazy. I would just like to thank all my friends and family. You know, when I got home, I drove 13 hours home, and when I pulled in the driveway, cars were lining the driveway, you know, and we had one heck of a party at the house. So, you know, that's the kind of things that just make it worthwhile, and the kind of support that you need, you know, to get out there and do that kind of stuff. So I just want to say thanks to all them and everything that they've done and the support that they've given me. It has been quite a ride.
Awesome. Well, Chris, thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate it, and congratulations again on the win.
Okay, appreciate it.
All righty. So, Kyle, we are back. Obviously, topic A number one is the All-American. I guess we've talked with Chris Macy. People know that he won it. Do you have anything about it that stuck out to you that you want to talk about? Because I was there. I mean, I can probably talk about it forever, but are there any burning questions that I can answer for you?
I think the obvious one is how dominant, like, the Ozarks region was in the All-American.
Dude,
I was pretty impressed by that.
I mean, so, like, if you look at Fitzpatrick, his best spot he got from a guy who lived near the lake, right? So,
yep.
On the one hand, he's Roger Fitzpatrick. He's a hammer. On the other hand, well, you know, got a little help. But that said, yeah, overall, like, the Ozarks crushed it. You know, what was it? Four guys from the Ozarks in the top 10, I think?
Yeah.
It's wild, too, because, right? Yeah, because Lippy and
Patrick,
Bearhorst and Macy and Fitzpatrick. Yeah, yeah, it's wild, too, because, yep. Like, that... that region is always so tough. It's kicked out a bunch of All-American champions. And, like, just to see him, like, basically do it again in what is kind of one of the most stacked fields we've seen in the All-American, at least in a while. I know we've talked about it, and we haven't, like, really decided 100% it's the best. Roger Fitzpatrick thinks
but
it
it's
might...
definitely up
he
there.
Thinks, Roger Fitzpatrick yeah. thinks it might be the best, which is worth noting. But yeah, man, what a showing from the Ozarks, and really, like, it's a lot of the same going on, but it was also a pretty fun derby.
Yeah, it did seem like there was enough difference within some of the same stuff. I guess I kind of got a feel for it while the event was going on, but maybe give me a better rundown of, like, how much of Hartwell, like, percentage were guys targeting? Like, did they spread out as much as you would think they did, or was it a smaller chunk of the lake really kicked out the bulk of the top finishers?
I would say they fished like 25% of the lake.
Yeah.
You know, like, that lower end, basically from takeoff to the dam, was so busy, especially the area. There was some kind of state park or something like that. I forget what it was called. But, like, I would say, especially just sort of the lower end entirely, or maybe the middle of the lower end, it was where it went down. You know, it was mostly where Chris Macy was fishing. But it's interesting. There were a few, like, selected spots closer up toward takeoff. And then Jamie Rampe used the Seneca River quite a bit. He used it on day one. He used it on day three. And for that, he ran all the way up, like, past Clemson, past the football stadium, up, you know, almost into Kiowa, just about.
Dang.
Which,
that's, you know, Jamie does that.
Yeah, he does that.
Right? So that's not really that big of a surprise.
And it's not really, like, that far away. I mean, it takes a little bit time to get there because you've got some idle zones and stuff, but it's not like making a run on the Great Lakes where you've got a chance to hit really bad weather or something, you know, like, it's going to be calm.
Yeah, right, right.
It's all a thin, narrow, windy kind of run. You can do it at 70. So it was there. Then the other guy that was interesting was Kip Carter, and he was up the Tougaloo, like, a really long way.
Oh yeah.
But there were very few other people up there with him, and very few other people who fished in the Tougaloo arm who did well. Like, Fitzpatrick, I think, caught maybe one or two fish in the Tougaloo arm. Bearhorst caught, like, maybe one or two fish in that arm. So it helped some people, but you probably could have deleted it from the tournament, and other than Kip Carter, I don't know that it really would have affected things, because, you know, Fitzpatrick or Bearhorst probably could have found somewhere else to catch their fish.
Yeah.
So it was interesting how you could get to that lower end, and there were times where you could see, like, three of the top five within a mile of each other. You know, he'd be like, he's on that point, he's in that pocket, he's over there. You know what I mean? Like, it was definitely, you could tell that the consistency, the numbers of, let's say, 2-pound spotted bass, 2.25-pound spotted bass, like, that was the place to be. And, like, you know, if you look up the river, like, day one up the Seneca River, Brian New went up the river, sucked it up. Brian New doesn't do that, you know. He's not bad. He's great. So that was, like, kind of a weird thing. Rampy went up the river on day one. He said he lost two big ones. If he catches those, all of a sudden it's a much different tournament. In fact, if he catches those, he probably wins the tournament, because it was close enough, and it's Jamie Rampe enough that heck, he probably could have caught those and then weighed 11 pounds a day from down in the lake and maybe won. You know what I mean? If he'd had a really big bag on day one. So, I don't know. It was a cool tournament. I've never covered a tournament with Hartwell before. You know, I've been around the lake enough to, like, have an idea of what's out there, but it was good to see it in the fall. And, man, I do really like that lake. It's cool.
It is super cool.
Have you ever gone up the Toogaloo Arm very much?
Yeah, a couple times.
I never had before. Like, I still never really went very far. You know, I went up to... My boat driver said it was, I think, where Christy won. The year, like, this was a long time ago, when he won there with a spinnerbait.
Yep.
And which may well have been the case. It may not have been. He did seem to know basically where things were going down. But anyway, so I guess I went up to there. I didn't really go much beyond that. But I really wanted to go up and look at what and watch Kip Carter. I would have loved to have, if we'd had, like, a full field of camera boats, I absolutely would have been like, you know what? I think I'm going to go check out Kip in the morning and just watch him. Because he had this starting spot, which was just a little point. And, man, on day one and day two, he said, like, he would sit down and catch, like, you know, 15 keepers or so. Maybe not 15, maybe 10. You know, call up to, like, 7 or 8 pounds. Just go on his way. Throwing a handmade crankbait. And didn't really work out the final day, but still a pretty cool thing to do, you know? That's one thing I wish I had figured out why the final day was so tough. Because.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Dude, it was way worse than day one and day two. And the weather, it was post-frontal. That's the excuse, right? At the same time, Chris Macy had his best day of the tournament that day, which helped him to win. But man, a lot of guys couldn't even scratch out 10 pounds. And that's kind of shocking, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, like, sitting around and it was almost, you know, noon central time. And I was like, man, we haven't really gotten any updates of anyone, like, cracking on them yet. Like, is this just going to be the lamest final day ever?
I know, because there were, like, a lot of guys who didn't have limits. And like, two guys didn't weigh in limits on the final day. And, you know, Chris Macy didn't really, he didn't really start catching them until later on in the day. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was weird.
Now, on the one hand, I was thinking, like, well, you know, here it is. This is fall fishing in the South. You know, I felt like the first 2 days actually, I guess, were pretty decent compared to that final day. So, you know, it is what it is. That's what we get for, you know, having to schedule one of these things in the fall. But also, I was like, gosh, I just really thought it was going to be more game on. Even though it was post-frontal, I figured we'd see some fireworks. But,
yeah.
Oh, well.
The thing is...
I mean, I guess Macy did, but other than that,
yeah. The thing is, there's so many fish in that lake.
Yeah.
It's, like, I think a lot of it is a pressure thing. I think that those fish are smart in that lake. And... Mm-hmm. The way they school and the way there's so much blueback, there's shad, like there's a lot of things they can do besides eat a bait, I think. And
yeah, right.
I think that they are they're sensitive to pressure. The lake is really, in the last month and a half, 2 months, it's gotten hit pretty dang hard. When you add in the open, the Ray Scott, and then all the people who probably came down and pre-fished and practiced for all those, plus the All-American, like, the fish are pretty educated. At the same time, it's kind of surprising that there wasn't another guy like Macy who, like, figured out a way to trigger it and unlock it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But either way, it was a good tournament. What do you think about the fall? Like, I really loved how you went straight from the regionals to the All-American, because then I could be like, hey, Roger, congratulations on winning that regional. Like, you knew some, even though it wasn't the same people from the regionals, right? Because the guys who won the regionals this year are qualifying for next year. I felt like I had BFLs on my mind more than usual. It wasn't trying to compete with a pro circuit event or something like that. Like, I loved it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. yeah, from that standpoint, I am all in. Like, I think it's a great way for it to have its own spotlight shown on it. There's not kind of a weird, like you said, it doesn't really slip off the back of your mind, and then all of a sudden it's April or May again, and you're like, oh yeah, we got the All-American, you know, amidst all the other stuff going on. So I thought that was really cool. I would totally be down for it to be this way again, because I feel like for the guys that qualified, you know, with the regionals, it seemed like they probably had time to go explore if they were going to go explore. And so, you know, I don't really think you're missing out on anything, like having it that soon.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I dig it.
Yeah, I definitely, it was cool. I don't, obviously next year's is scheduled for the spring already, right? Like it's not,
mm-hmm.
it's certainly something that we would need to do the year after, or, you know, right. even more going forward. But it was cool. I liked it. Let's see. What? Do we have anything else from that? Let's see. Oh,
well.
Cole Floyd having the riser bait on the final day but not the first 2 days was hilarious and awesome. And I'm so glad. Like, that bait is cool. I have got them in my tackle box. I haven't really encountered a scenario where I think they're going to work yet. But, God, I can't wait to find a day where that works. Because, man, it's a cool thing.
Yeah, I've never purchased one. Thought about it.
Yeah.
But not until you sent me the text about it did I really go, huh, maybe I should look into that.
Here, you probably shouldn't. Because I don't know really the application in Iowa, to be honest. And I feel like in Minnesota, I don't think you're going to need it, really. I mean, mate, there's probably a scenario. And honestly, like in Vermont, I don't know that I need it either, but I want to try it. I want to try it just to see at the same time, like, it's such a finesse bait. That I don't know, man. It seems, but spy baits work really good. Why not a spy bait on top? You know, I don't know. I go back and forth on whether it's worth it. And really, the thing that needs to be done is I need to throw the dang thing. So
yeah,
there we go.
I just want to be as cool as Cole Floyd is really what it boils down to.
Well, obviously, don't we all?
yeah, we all strive for it.
Hey. This is a side note, but Cole Floyd told a joke. And I'm going to insert it right here so people can listen to it. How heavy and what size for your swim bait?
I was using a half ounce. That's a half ounce.
Woo! Knocking them out.
Quarter ounce.
Okay.
Half ounce. Yeah, I was using 1 ounce now.
And then Kyle, I'll send it to you later and you can laugh about it. All right. Cue. That was our Cole Floyd joke. It was great, everybody. Please appreciate it as much as Kyle and I do. Or at least as much as I do. Kyle doesn't know if he likes it or not yet.
Yeah, I technically haven't heard it yet. Yeah. But I'm sure I will.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be spectacular. I'm just telling you. Get ready. Buckle up. Wild ride. Let's see. We had some guys who qualify for the Toyota Series Championship, correct?
Yes. So from the All-American, it was the top finishers from each of the six regionals, the wild card and the TBF National Championship, all qualified to fish in the Toyota Series Championship coming up here in a couple of weeks. So this would have been... you got to think back to 20. What year are we in? We're in 2020.
We're in 2020.
But this would have been
last year.
The guys from 2019.
Yeah.
So from the first regional on Hartwell last year, it's Todd Goad. Second regional out of Seminole was Randall Allen. The Kentucky Lake regional was Cary Fray. Potomac River Regional was Bradford Beavers. The Gunners Regional, or Gunnersville Regional, Cole Floyd. Chris Macy out of the Grand Lake Regional. Brian Dowdy qualifies out of the wild card last year. And then out of the TBF National Championship is Blake Wilson. So those are your eight boaters that are moving on. We have eight co-anglers as well, which actually they're like the co-angler field, or the guys that made it from the co-angler side are like, it's pretty pretty stout. Obviously, Justin Kimmel, who won the co-angler All-American title, he's going. Mark Blankenship, dude crushes a lot from the back of the boat. Who else? That Larry Rothwell, he led the first couple days, didn't he?
He was definitely up there.
At the All-American?
I took photos of him. Yeah. For sure.
But anyway, so that's just one more piece to the Toyota Series Championship field. It's, I guess, in theory set, the field list, especially considering the Toyota Series regular season is all wrapped up now. But that's the final pieces of the puzzle for that.
Yeah, I think that field is basically... I think there's a couple people who might drop out or not drop out, basically. Yeah, I think it's basically full.
Yeah, and I think sometimes part of this, too, like we've mentioned on here, the West Coast guys that, you know, don't come out for it. Who knows how that's going to go this year with, like, COVID and California and whatever that is. But
yeah, there's that. There's one thing that's weird, and I think it's all sort of settled for now anyhow, is the guys traveling from out of country to come fish it, because there's an international division. It's pared down significantly this year. I assume it'll be back in bigger numbers on a non-COVID year, but I know for like a lot of the, you know, anglers, it's like hard to get permission to leave the country and then come back in the country and stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
It's not a tip. It's not like normal, by any means. But it'll be a really cool tournament. That's for sure.
Yep.
Want to talk Table Rock? Give me the lowdown, man.
Yeah. So I guess 2 weeks ago, the Plains Division closed out on Table Rock. You've maybe heard of this guy. His name's Cody Huff.
Does he do something with sonar?
He like,
oh, it's forward-facing sonar that he uses.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of his deal, I guess.
Yeah,
he
baby.
Won it. He had 46 pounds, 4 ounces, over 3 days of fishing. Catching him suspended. It was pretty much almost exactly like how he won on Toledo Bend back in February of this year for his first series event win, which was also right after he won the BASS college event on Toledo Bend. So
Cody Huff, I mean, might be good.
Been a pretty good year for him. The only difference, he won Toledo Bend. He was fishing like main river and using a jigging spoon. On Table Rock, he was fishing kind of like the middle of the creeks where bait was kind of suspended. I guess if you followed along and you don't remember, Table Rock, they got a bunch of rain and the lake came up like 4 feet, which is a lot for Table Rock. And the fish got all weird. The bait pushed in the back of the pockets, and some of the fish just, instead of like going with them, just started suspending over really deep water. Cody Huff found that out like 3 hours into practice and was like, oh, I don't know, I might be able to like do something with this. and then went ahead and did something with it. So,
yeah, who knows?
Yeah, it was
maybe
pretty
it'll
cool.
Be
he,
good.
Caught, he caught him on a jigging wrap pretty much the first 2 days. The final day, the fishing changed yet again. It was gorgeous weather every day. It was like really light wind, like 70 degrees, sunny. The final day, a lot of the fish that Huff was targeting, a lot of the schools, had moved, and he got on isolated smallmouths kind of just a little farther out than where he'd been fishing. And they were like 10 feet down over 100 feet of water. And he would see him on his forward-facing sonar, throw a little swim bait at him, and catch him. And, yeah, that's how He held off Jason Lieblong, who won Angler of the Year for the Plains Division. Jason had a really good final day. He was running way up the, I guess he was running up the James.
He was.
So yeah, it was a pretty cool tournament. Like Spencer Sheffield, let's see.
He huffed it.
Yeah, he did. So Huff, Sheffield.
Huff and Sheff, baby. The Livescope team.
Huff and Sheff, Aaron Hodge, Cole Breeden, and I think that, yeah, those guys all did like the suspended fish forward-facing sonar thing. The rest of the guys pretty much like put a jig in their hand, pitched it around docks, and caught bass. Handful of guys went up the river. Most of the guys kept it from like Mill Creek, which is up above Kimberling City a little bit, all the way down to the dam. And like most of those guys, especially like Sheffield and Hodge and even Cole Breeden, a lot of them are running like a lot of water throughout the course of the day. Get in, you know, sonar around with your trolling motor. If you don't see anything, move on to the next pocket. And yeah, it was interesting. Definitely did not see a jig and wrap coming out. I know it's, I've heard about it in the Ozarks before, but again, like we don't have a lot of fall tournaments where it would come into play. Like Huff was saying, this is basically kind of a winter thing, right?
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Exactly.
To me. So it was kind of cool to get to see it play out. The conditions really set up perfectly for it. If it would have been windy every day of the tournament and same conditions, guys probably would have caught them better on like a spinnerbait or a plopper or something. Yeah.
And
kind of normal Ozark stuff.
I mean, we know this, but it is dramatically more difficult to fish with live scope when it's windy than when it's not. Like when your boat is moving around out of your control more and you're trying to see things that are pretty fine margins already, it gets trickier.
Yeah. Yep. But all in all, pretty cool event. Obviously, Huff is qualified to fish for the Toyota Cedars Championship on Cumberland. He's pretty fired up about it. It seems like it could be a tournament that plays to his wheelhouse. So I think, you know, obviously he's kind of a front runner for who to keep an eye on. And I will certainly be bugging him a lot in practice. So
yes. There is a crew of potential live scope anglers in that tournament.
Yeah.
Who, and there's people who are strapping live scope on right now who are getting ready for that tournament.
Yep.
And it's, remember, let's see, it almost feels like, do you remember not the, maybe not Beaver Lake, but it almost feels like the, I don't even know what it would have been called. The Toyota Series, the Rayovac, the Everstarts. It was a while ago. But the championship they had on Kentucky Lake right after the Alabama rig won on Gunnersville, where like guys were busting out umbrella rigs and getting ready to like go do this. And we're a little farther along in the process, and it seems like LiveScope isn't likely to get banned at a variety of levels like the Alabama rig has. But it almost feels like that, where it's like we're like hurtling towards something.
Yeah, like there's probably going to be some stuff seen at the Toyota Series Championship this year, you know, that's going to keep unlocking the secret for people that have, you know, fished that lake and, you know, never even bothered chasing fish that these guys are going to go after or something like that.
Well, I think a lot of the people who fish that lake know it. Like, either they're either guys who are like, man, I should get live scope, and they haven't, and they're probably about to
be convinced.
And they
just keep cranking the bank?
Yeah. Or, you know, they're guys, because, like, live scope doesn't always win on that lake. There's folks who have had it there and caught fish on it and done well in tournaments. But they also probably aren't as good as Cody Huff and Spencer Sheffield and like Dakota Ebert, like some of the guys who are about to descend on that lake with live scope.
Yeah, like, see, that's kind of the angle I'm getting at.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting tournament because there are some really historic, really good ways to win on that lake, right? We saw it with Upshaw last year. We're kind of getting into our Toyota Series Championship preview by accident, but you know what? We'll do it right now, right?
It happens.
You know, yeah. We saw it with Upshaw last year. We saw how he won with a jig on bluffs, like super classic. We saw how so many guys in the top 10 cranked for smallmouth, which, like, super yep. classic, works super good. You know, you saw, heck, you saw Steve Floyd go in the back of Fishing Creek and flip and make the cut. Like, there were,
yep.
last yep. year, everyone fished, or almost everyone, fished Cumberland, like, exactly how you're supposed to fish Cumberland. And this year, it's later in the year, so the fishing should be better.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is coming to that lake thinking that everyone knows how you're supposed to fish the lake. I think everyone in the field also knows that we've seen a lot of lakes this year get beat with guys fishing with live scope when other people were doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Yep.
So that's the thing to watch out for. I mean, Patrick Definitely. Walters did it. Cody Huff did it at Toledo Bend. I guess Table Rock, like, I don't know that that was a, probably wasn't really much of a surprise considering how many guys are were doing it. Also, considering how quick Spencer Sheffield got on him in practice. His Instagram yeah. in practice is like one of the all-time just domination sessions. I loved it.
Oh, yeah, dude. He was on them from the word go.
Yeah, he, like, put the boat in, probably, and was like, oh, wait, drop here. There's one. Whoop.
He told me, like, when he looked at the weather before he got there for practice and, like, saw the rain, the lake was coming up, he's like, those fish are going to suspend. I'm going to go find them with live scope. And he went out and, boop, caught, like, a 3-pound smallmouth. Then he caught, like, a 4-pound smallmouth. He caught, like, a 5- or 6-pound largemouth. Yeah, he was pretty much just like, here we go.
Yeah. I was really hoping, I mean, no shade on Jason, because he crushed him. But I was really hoping that Huff and Shuff would be, like, literally neck and neck. And I, dude, could you imagine if they were tied after day two? The headline, Ooh. Huff and Shuff tied at the Rock, baby. How cool would that have been? But, alas.
Oh, that would have been sweet.
Anyway. Shall we mention Seminole now that we've talked about everything else?
Oh yeah. The other event that happened.
Yeah, the other event that happened. So anyway.
Well, I say that because I wasn't there, but it also was occurring at the same time.
Yeah. Well, neither of us were there. I just edited Rob Newell's stories and photos and posted Jacob Fine's stories and photos. Or, well, he didn't write any stories, but you get the drift.
I'm following it.
Yeah, so the fun thing about this one was that Shoal Bass actually played.
Yeah.
It was not a particularly... the lake was fishing bad enough that you could catch Shoal Bass and do well. Now, the guy who won actually didn't catch all Shoal Bass. He caught several largemouth as well. They were most of his bigger fish. But Keith Poche ran up the river, up the Flint, in a boat that he would not have been allowed to fish out of in a Tackle Warehouse Pro Circuit event. Oh, gosh. But he was A-okay for this event. Ran way up the river past where any normal boat can go. Which, I mean, having a boat that can do that is an advantage. Or is, maybe. Depends.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway. Ran way up. He caught 17-14 on day one, 13-2 on day three. That was the day he caught a bunch of shoal bass. And then 15-6 on the final day. Basically, he was flipping wood or throwing a spinnerbait were, like, pretty much the two main things he did. And it was a super cool way to win, to be honest. He only had 46 yeah. pounds, which, like, really, in the scheme of things, is not that much.
I mean, it was basically Huff's winning weight from Table Rock.
Yeah, but no smallmouth.
Yeah. But Shoal Bass.
Shoal Bass, yeah. We didn't get to see any of it, though, because we couldn't get to him.
Yeah, yeah.
Midway true. Through the day two weigh-in, I was, like, texting random people. Well, not random people. I was texting J. Todd Tucker. I was like, hey, do you know anyone down there who's got one of these boats? Because we might need to pinch hit for a camera boat. And Rob Newell was like, nah, it won't get one in the river. We'll be fine. There might be one or two guys in there. And I was like, oh, okay, Rob, I trust you. And couldn't find a camera boat anyway. And Rob's apparently never been more surprised in his life than when Poche won that tournament. But hey. So Mikey Kiso Jr. Got second. He had 45.9. He was doing what you're supposed to do. He was down the lake punching.
Yep.
The interesting thing about what he was doing, and this is like legitimately, I'm almost more interested in this than I am in LiveScope, just because I feel like we know what we're getting into with LiveScope. This was like, he was flipping, well, punching really, hydrilla, but he was most of the time didn't have his trolling motor in the water. Like he was trying to be extremely stealthy. He was trying to fish the thickest stuff too, because his theory was that especially around Spring Creek or, you know, that lower end where there was a lot of traffic, was that it was driving the fish farther and farther into the mats. So like as guys would flip around the edge, he'd catch some, and the fish wanted to. They would actually just go into the middle more and more. And so he was following them in there as stealthily as he possibly could. It was super cool and something that will, like, no doubt be replicated going forward. So, anyway, that was
it. Oh, yeah. The on-the-water photos are kind of funny because you're like, man, is this trolling motor broken? But he's got, you know, there's, like, gobs of grass.
Yeah, it's like, nope, he's just trying to slide along with the breeze.
Yeah, just moving and grooving.
Yeah. Which, I mean, there's a lot of scenarios where, like, generally, I would say I prefer to fish with the wind if possible, right? I guess it kind of depends, but generally I think going with the wind is a smart thing, or can be, and it was like the perfect example of you can be that extra little bit stealthy, and he was probably catching a few extra fish. Because, boy, if you looked at the people behind him, like, you know, the idea that Jason Smith and Gary Milicevic and the McMillan brothers, Jared and Dylan, by the way, can't flip, like, you're wrong, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was cool. Brian New got third. He was fishing up the Chattahoochee. He caught a lot of fish on an umbrella rig. Shocker. Jared McMillan and Dylan McMillan finished fourth and fifth. Jared led day one. Dylan led day two. Dylan caught 24-14 on day two. Just a mega bag. Dylan was actually catching some fish on a jerkbait, like on the edges of the grass, with live scope. but anyway, it was a cool derby, I would say.
It was. We've, you know, for the McMillan note, we've heard from Jared and Brandon that Dylan is like the best McMillan. And I know we've talked about it on here before, but, after he dropped that big bag on day two, it was like, holy crap, they weren't lying. Like, he can't, the youngest one can catch him.
Dude, what an incredible, first of all, when he took the, I really wanted a McMillan to win because, like, that is who Rob Newell is put on this earth to write about.
Yeah.
And to have him there to write Dylan and Jared day one, day two, well, Jared and Dylan, it was perfect. Like, they were very good stories, especially the Dylan McMillan one. But, man, it was cool it was just very cool to see both brothers there while Brandon was probably back dropping off packages. It was neat.
Yeah, it was. It was.
I'm curious. I don't know if Dylan fished, like, the whole schedule or not. I think he probably did. Yeah, so he finished third overall in points. I wonder if he's going to fish the pro circuit next year.
Ooh.
I'm going to text. I'll text Brandon. Brandon feels like, I feel like he usually gets back a little bit faster.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Fish the Pro. Because, man, that would be cool if, like, literally, basically the entire McMillan family was on tour. That would be fun. But anyway, I guess that's what I got from that one. AOI was Trevor Fitzpatrick, or Trevor Fitzgerald. A lot of Fitzes in this one.
A lot of Fitzes.
Anyway, he crushed him all year long, basically, as expected.
Yep.
I assume he will fish the pro circuit next year, which...
Yeah, I would think
so. I would think so, and I'm sure he will do well, because he's good. Kyle, is there anything else we need to hit on?
Well, I think we could at least mention... we'll have... we got the BFL wildcard happening this weekend on Lake of the Ozarks.
That's a good point. That's just a...
I think we do.
We do. It's just a two-day event. And I think it's Friday and Saturday? Or am I wrong about that?
I think so. No, I think you're right.
Either way.
Right?
Well, it's definitely going on.
Yeah, it's happening.
It's happening. That'll be our last crew of people to qualify for next year's All-American.
Yes.
Except... Maybe do we still have to have guys qualify for the TBF National Championship next spring? Either way, last BFL crew, for sure.
Yeah, yep.
And
then after that, it's just the Toyota Series Championship on Cumberland, beginning of December. And then that's all she wrote for 2020, tournament-wise.
Brandon says, yes, that is. Brandon McMillan reports... That probably not, but he's trying to talk him into it. So.
That's a good big brother.
Yeah, he's like, hey, man, you really should get in. Spend money. It's like, yeah. It'd be great if you could fish. I'll even teach you how to use a spinning rod, but only a little ways after practice at Smith Lake, not right at the beginning. You know?
Not initially.
You know, just after, once I found them, you know. If Gussie tells me where they are. Oh, gosh, I miss Gussie. I've been thinking about Gussie a lot more, though, lately, because I've been thinking about ice fishing a lot more. Side note.
Yes.
Whole pond is covered with ice now.
Side note. I got a little package of stuff in the mail heading your way. I got shipping confirmation on it, so, you know.
Yes.
Be ready.
Let me know what I owe you for shipping or for any of the stuff.
You don't owe me a dang thing, Jody.
All right. That goose sticker really did it.
It did.
Excellent. Well, cool. I would say we're pretty much wrapped up then.
Yeah, I think we got to get rolling. I got to go take care of the little one here so the wife can get out of the house for a hot second. And, yeah, you got to, like, get your computer worked on. So will we podcast next week? A pre-Thanksgiving podcast or no?
I would say that... Hopefully will, but really a lot depends on the computer.
Technology, man.
Yeah, it's something else. but anyhow, it's worked for this entire podcast so far, so we'll see.
Yes, it has.
But anyway, Kyle, as always, thanks for talking with me. Folks, if you want more FLW, we've got all sorts of social media outlets. FLWfishing.com is a great place to be. You can even send us an email.
You absolutely can. And you have a couple options. Whatever you want.
They go to the same place.
Yeah. Podcast at FLWfishing.com, MajorLeagueFishing.com. Whatever floats your boat. We love hearing from you.
Yes. And please tell us if you want us to talk more about ice fishing. If you want us to talk less about it, don't tell us.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, Kyle, as always, was a pleasure.
It absolutely was. I guess good luck with your computer. And, you know, until next time. See ya.